Last week we started looking at the story of David, the second king of Israel. We saw him as he was a boy. We saw him stand up against the mighty giant of the Philistines, Goliath. We saw his faith in action. We saw that he trusted God and he was a man after God's own heart, unlike the current king at the time, King Saul. And so we saw a contrast in the faithfulness of David and the faithlessness of Saul. As we continue to go through the story of David, you'll see that more and more. And you'll see the polarization between David's faithfulness and Saul's faithlessness. As we go through the story today, we're also going to continue on our story with David and with Saul, but we're going to look at, most importantly, at one other guy, another character that we really haven't talked much about yet, and that is Jonathan. Okay? And we'll see a lot about the relationship between Jonathan and David and Jonathan and Saul. To get us into this, who was Jonathan? Well, if we turn to chapter 14 of 1 Samuel, verse 49, we see that Saul had five children. He had three sons, Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua, and then he also had a couple of daughters, Merab and Michal. So what we see is that Jonathan was one of three sons. The fact that he's listed first tells us that he was the firstborn son. And the interactions that we see with Jonathan make it clear that he was the firstborn son. With that comes all the privileges and responsibilities of being a firstborn son, but being firstborn son of the king means that you're the prince, you are the heir apparent. You are the prince that's in line to become the next king. So he was the one in line to become the next king. The first time we hear about Jonathan is back in chapter 13 that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. We see that Saul was 30 years old when he became king. And when he finally started acting like a king, we see in verse 2 that Saul chose 3,000 men from Israel. 2,000 were with him at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah in Benjamin. The rest of the men he sent back to their homes. So we see that Jonathan, even though he couldn't have been more than a teenager at this point, if Saul was 30, and even maybe this even happened a few years after he was anointed king, which is what verse 1 might be referring to, or when he was presented to the people as king, we still see that he couldn't have been more than a teenager, but yet Saul was already preparing his son for leadership. And Saul had Jonathan with one-third of his army at Gibeah and Benjamin. Okay. And we see a leadership potential of Jonathan there. Now, we see while he's there at Gibeah, he takes action. Okay, while Saul's kind of sitting around with his 2,000 men, we see that Jonathan takes some action. Verse 3, it says that Jonathan attacked the Philistine outpost of Geba, and the Philistines heard about it. So we see that Saul, Saul's son Jonathan, as a young buck, he couldn't just sit around, so he took the initiative, and he, without thinking about what was on the other side of what he was doing here, he attacks the Philistine outpost. Saul had the trumpet blown throughout the land and said, "Let the Hebrews hear." So all Israel heard the news that Saul has attacked the Philistine outpost, and now Israel has become a stench to the Philistines. And the people were then summoned to join Saul at Gilgal because they knew that the Philistines were going to come upon them with force. The Philistines didn't like the idea of their outpost being attacked. That was an attack. So they respond in force. We see that when the Philistine army assembled to fight Israel, we see in verse 5, they showed up with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. That's as many soldiers as Saul had, as the Israelite army had. In verse 2, we had 3,000 men. 2,000 were with Saul and 1,000 with Gibeah. So there were enough chariots from the Philistines, twice as many charioteers, to match one chariot against one Israelite soldier, not counting all the foot soldiers that the Philistines had. So a massive force. As a result, the army started melting away, so that we see that eventually in verse 15, they had all run away or were hiding, so that all that were left with Saul was about 600. So what Jonathan did prompted an opportunity for God to act, because there's no way that 600 men could defend themselves or even have any concept of victory over such a massive Philistine army. But we see that Jonathan wasn't concerned with that. Even though everyone else was afraid and melting away, the army was melting away, people were running away, Jonathan remained faithful, and Jonathan was faithful. You can see in 14 verse 6, he says to his young armor bearer, come, let's go over to the outpost. This is another outpost of those uncircumcised fellows. Perhaps Yahweh will act in our behalf. Nothing can hinder Yahweh from saving, whether by many or by few. So he knew that the battle is the Lord's. And if God wants victory, then God's going to give victory, whether it's with a big army of Israelites or with it's just few, just he and his armor bearer. Now, we've talked about in here that the most important thing that the Israelites needed to do before they took action on their own, what we're called to do as well, is we're called to seek the Lord and look to him for guidance. And we see that Jonathan said this, but he hadn't sought the Lord yet, right? So how would he know if God was with him? Well, we see that in verse 8. Jonathan says, come then, we'll cross over towards the men and let them see us. If they say to us, wait there until we come to you, well, then we'll stay where we are and we won't go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we'll climb up, because that will be our sign that Yahweh has given them into our hands. So that is his inquiring of God. He's trusting God for this victory, but he's also trusting, he also recognizes that he cannot make God bring victory. Just because they're few doesn't mean that God wants or will give victory. So he gives, he says, this will be the sign that God is blessing what we're doing here. So what happened then? Well, Jonathan got the sign that he was looking for. In verse 12, it says, the men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come to us and we'll teach you a lesson. Jonathan goes, okay, there's our sign. Let's go. In verse 13, Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. So he was fighting, you see this swashbuckling kind of action with his sword, injuring, killing some of the Philistines, injuring them, but the armor bearer mopping up behind him, making sure that they were dead. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area about a half an acre. So it was a concentrated group of people, 20 people in a half an acre, and Jonathan killed them all. And his armor bearer, because they trusted God for success. So then God took that faith of Jonathan that initiated this action, and God worked on that to provide a great success for the Israelite army here. We see in verses 15 and 16, it says, then panic struck the whole army. This is the army of the Philistines, those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah of Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. So God used that, and God brought a panic upon the Philistines. They heard about this attack at the outpost. Obviously, the message may be said that it was a much greater attack than two guys, but there was a panic that went off, and God added to it by bringing a little earthquake here. So the Philistines were in a panic, and they were running away. They were scattering. Saul's lookout, Saul's spies saw that, and so they ran into a mop-up effort here. Now, during the mop-up effort of trying to chase down the Philistines and kill them as they fled, what did Jonathan do during that time? Verse 24, now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the troops tasted any food. But, verse 27, Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, because he was out attacking the Philistine outpost, right? So he reached out the end of his staff that was in his hand and dipped it into a honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Or another translation of that, his strength was renewed. So Jonathan didn't know about the stupid command that his father had made, and as he was chasing Philistines, he ate a little bit of honey, and that was against what his father's command was, and that posed a problem. So what happened as a result of the situation? Verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you've done. So Jonathan told him, I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now must I die? Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die? He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never! As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. So as a result of his action, he unknowingly ate a little bit of honey, and not realizing that there was this command, stupid command though it was, and his sentence for doing that by his dad was execution. And his dad, to guarantee that it would happen, swore by God. He said, "May God deal with me ever so severely." So he made an oath to God. An oath to God is something you can never break. But Saul did. Saul was swayed by the men. His interest was in pleasing the men more than it was with pleasing God. We've seen other stories dealing with that. And so you see his lack of faithfulness to God. Yes, it was a bad oath. He should never have made the oath. He should never have made the command in the first place, but he should not have made the oath swearing by God that Jonathan should die. But the fact that he did, it's worse that he did not fulfill the oath, that he broke his oath to God. So this is what we have seen so far about Jonathan as we've looked in our stories to date. Now, that brings us to chapter 18. We left off last week at chapter 17 after we saw David, and we saw the story of David killing Goliath and bringing victory to the Israelites over the Philistines through that victory. So what happened after David killed Goliath? We saw before that David had been enlisted as part of the musician group that would soothe Saul whenever evil spirits or evil spirits came upon him, when he was tormented, when he went into depression or went into some kind of torment. And so David would travel back and forth between his home and Saul's home in Gibeah, and to do his shift as being a musician. But we also kind of saw that Saul really never paid any attention to him. David was just another musician. You know, to a king, he was a servant, just like any of the other servants. There were other servants who would organize and coordinate the musicians, so people in Saul's service would have known who David was, but Saul really didn't. And then we have this story of David and Goliath, where David then is known by Saul, very much so. So where did David live then? Did David then go back home? Did he continue his musician route where he would go back and forth? Well, that's where we go to chapter 18. Verse 2. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. Okay, so after the victory, the king can say, "This person's mine." He stays here, and that's what Saul did. He kept David there. Now we kind of see that with back in chapter 16, verse 21, says that which this was actually speaking ahead. David came to Saul and entered his service. Saul liked him very much, and David became one of his armor bearers. And Saul sent word to Jesse, "Allow David to remain in my service, for I am pleased with him." So we see that that was kind of speaking ahead to this time, to where now David no longer goes home. He stays with Saul at Gibeah. He stays in Saul's household. What about Jonathan? Jonathan is the one of the sons. What did Jonathan think about this new addition to the family? Verse 1, after David finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. So much so that Jonathan, in verse 3, made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. So you see that a very, very strong friendship formed here between Jonathan and David, and it wasn't... We don't see that it was initiated by David, but rather it was initiated by Jonathan. Jonathan befriended David and enjoyed David as much as he enjoyed himself, okay, and loved David as much as he loved himself. So much so that we see that he took off the robe that he was wearing, gave his robe, gave his tunic, gave his sword, gave his bow, gave his belt. This is a sign of a covenant. And he makes this covenant. We see in verse 3, it says, Jonathan made a covenant with David. And in covenants in those times, you would give your clothing, you would give your weapons, you would give of yourself to the covenant party, and all of that symbolized but also claimed that what I have is yours. Your enemies are my enemies. My strength is your strength. And so we see that Jonathan makes that covenant with David. We kind of gather that the two are very close in age. Okay, they're probably both teenagers at this time of at some level, maybe within a couple years of each other. So that's how Jonathan reacted to David. What about other members of the royal family? Well, if you zoom over to verse 20, you see that Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. So his youngest daughter, he had the two daughters, Merab and Michal, and Michal fell in love with David. So you've got a good friendship with Jonathan. You've got this crush, I guess, from Michal of David. What about others? What did others feel about David? We're seeing some friendliness, some people liking David from within the royal family. What about others? Verse 5. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This is a young buck here. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. So we see that God gave David success in everything, and as a result, people were pleased. Everyone was pleased with him. Everyone? Okay, we've seen Jonathan, we've seen Michal, we've seen others. What about Saul? Well, going on. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his tens of thousands." Well, Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They've credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands? What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. So we see that Saul, and this is the beginning of some animosity that's just going to continue to grow and grow and grow. We'll see it today as well, that Saul is very jealous of David and keeps this jealous eye on him. We see paranoia will set in about Saul wanting to protect his kingship. So how serious was this jealousy of Saul early on here like this? Well, verse 10, the next day, so this is just right then, the next day an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. So twice, it wasn't just kind of an impromptu action. This was something that he was serious about. "I'm sick of this kid. I'm going to get rid of him." And he throws his sword and throws his spear, and David eludes it, does it twice. He's very jealous about David. As long as David's around, it's going to continue to be a problem, okay? And it's just going to get worse. So he's got to get David out of his sight. What does he do to get David out of his sight? Verse 12. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men. This is a very young guy. Now he's commanding 1,000 soldiers. And David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. He sends David off on military campaigns, and that gets him out of his sight. So when Saul sees how successful David is, David brings success to the military, does that make him feel better about David? Because this is really what a king wants, is military success, and he's got this great general or commander that's out there doing this great work. Verse 15, when Saul saw how successful David was, he was afraid of him. But all of Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. Okay, so the success that David had, rather than being happy about the peace and the victorious aspects of the kingdom that David was bringing, Saul just gets more and more upset and is more and more afraid of David. David is getting more and more powerful, and that bothers Saul. Now, what had been rumored, if you remember back to chapter 17 with David and Goliath, there's a rumor that was going around that whoever had the guts to stand up against this Goliath fella, that the king would do something for him. What was that? Verse 25. Now, the Israelites had been saying, do you see how this man keeps coming out? How he comes out to defy Israel? The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He'll also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel. We don't see that Saul said these things. We see more so that this is a rumor. It never really comes out and says that Saul says this. But there's a thought there. Oh, surely the king will give great wealth. And it probably just built on that. Oh, he'll give his daughter in marriage. Oh, he'll exempt whoever's family from taxes. So it kind of grows. Now, whether Saul did make these promises or not, did he fulfill any of them? Well, did he, for instance, the offering his daughter, did Saul offer his daughter to David in marriage as was rumored here? Well, verse 17 of chapter 18. Saul said to David, here is my older daughter Merib. I'll give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord. So we see that he offers his daughter's hand in marriage, but you see, it's contingent upon David continuing to serve and to fight the battles of God. Why? Well, for Saul said to himself, I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that. Okay, if I can get this guy to marry and to marry one of my daughters, you know, he's kind of using his daughter as a pawn here. Well, the Philistines are not only, right now they're upset with David because David's having all these victories over him, but he's going to become a personal target if he is married to the daughter of the king. So this will be something that will really get the Philistines to chase him down. Let the Philistines get him as a result. So did Saul's tactic work? Verse 18, David said to Saul, who am I? And what is my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law? So when the time came for Merib, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was instead given in marriage to Adriel of Maholah. So David didn't, in his humility, he was too humble, and he was too humble to accept Merib as a wife. So she ended up getting married to another man. But Saul still thinks it's a good idea. So how does he try again? Verse 20. Now Saul's daughter Michal was in love with David. When they told Saul about it, he was pleased. He goes, I'll give her to him, he thought, so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hands of the Philistines may be against him. So Saul said to David, now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law. So the fact that his daughter Michal loved David and flirted with him and hung all around him a lot, there was something. And then verse 22, Saul ordered his attendant, speak to David privately. Because he said no before. So speak to him privately and say, look, the king is pleased with you. And his attendants all like you. Now, become his son-in-law. So he's trying to grease the skid so that David will say yes. Again, his purpose here is not because he wants David to become his son-in-law. Not because he's pleased with David. But rather, it will make David a bigger target for the Philistines. And hopefully help get rid of this problem. So, how did David respond? Well, Saul knows that David's going to be humble and David's going to say no, but Saul also knows that David likes to prove himself and David likes to take charge of things, of the situation. So how does Saul play on David's humility and his desires to further his intent here? Verse 23. The attendants repeated these words to David, but David said, do you think it's a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known. I'm a nobody. Well, he wasn't little known. Everyone knew who this captain of the army was that was winning all these battles. When Saul's servants told him what David had said, Saul replied, say to David, the king wants no other price. In other words, you say you're poor, you don't have money for a bride price? Okay, well, the king wants no other price for the bride than 100 Philistine foreskins to take revenge on his enemies. Saul's plan here was to have David fall by the hands of the Philistines. So David would be focused on collecting these 100 foreskins. Well, how does he do that? Well, a Philistine's not going to give that up without the fight. So he has to kill 100 Philistines to get that. And Saul, and this is going to be a focus thing. So Saul's hope is that in the process of doing this, David will be killed. So what does David do? How does David respond to Saul's price? Verse 26. When the attendants told David these things, he was pleased to become the king's son-in-law. So that part worked. So before the allotted time had elapsed, so in other words, he didn't waste any time. He took off and he took care of this right away. And David and his men went out and killed not 100, but 200 Philistines. Okay, hell, you name 100, I'll get you 200. Quicker than you expect. David and his... So he brought their foreskins and presented the full number to the king so that he might become the king's son-in-law. Well, then Saul gave him his daughter Michal in marriage. So you see that he exceeded the requirements here. Did David's extra effort please Saul? When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michal loved David, Saul became even more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy for the rest of his days. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of all of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. So it kind of backfired, and God continued to give David success. The Philistines were not the able to kill David like Saul had hoped, and things just continued to get worse and worse for paranoid Saul. We've already seen he tries to throw a spear at David a couple of times. He's trying to get the Philistines to kill him, and that's not working. Where does he go from here? Going on, chapter 19. Saul told his son Jonathan, you're close to him, and all the attendants to kill David. Okay, so where do you go? You tell others, someone else to kill him. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I'll go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and I'll tell you what I find out." Saul gave the command for someone to kill David. He even tells Jonathan to. Well, Jonathan, as we've seen, is a very close friend, a loving friend to David. And so he's concerned about David, and so he goes to David. That's the first thing he does. And he goes, "David, my dad's trying to kill you, so you need to go hide." All right? Get out of here and go hide. I'll go talk to my dad, find out why he wants to kill you, find out what the deal is, and I'll fill you in. So what happens? Does Jonathan stand up to his dad for David? I mean, he's standing up against the king here. This is the same dad that had sworn to God that he would kill Jonathan for eating a little bit of honey. So it's a little risky talking about David, bringing up David's name, bringing up the name, and trying to defend the guy that Saul wants to kill. So does Jonathan do that? Verse 4, Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul his father and said, "Let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great victory for all of Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason?" Saul listened to Jonathan and took this oath, "As surely as the Lord lives." Well, we know how good that does as far as an oath from Saul. Well, he gives this oath, swears to God, "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He then brought David to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. So we see that Jonathan did stand up to defend David to Saul, and it worked. Okay, he convinced Saul that David's not a threat. He's doing your work. He's bringing you success and victory. And so Saul swore to God that he would not kill David. Okay. Was Saul's acceptance of David permanent? How well did he do to his oath here? Verse 8. Once more, war broke out, and David went out and fought the Philistines. He struck them with such force that they fled before him. But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand. While David was playing the harp, so you see jealousy over the success again, Saul tried to pin him to the wall with a spear. But David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. So we're not just talking about a little toss. We're talking he thrust it. With his force. We see force. If he's going to put the spear through the wall, there's a lot of force. They didn't have sheetrock back then. This is rock and mortar, and for it to go into the wall, that was with a lot of force. And he's trying to kill David here. So that night, David made good his escape there at the end of verse 10. So after David had another victory, Saul got more jealous, tried to spear him again. Luckily, either a bad shot or David was good at dodging spears. But you see, he's very serious about getting rid of him. Well, David's got a wife. He's married to Michal. Michal loves him. How does Michal save David when she hears that her dad wants to kill David, kill her husband? Verse 11. Saul sent men to David's house to watch it and to kill him in the morning. Okay, so they're going to wait outside the house. As David comes out, they'll take care of him. But Michal, David's wife, warned him, "If you don't run for your life tonight, tomorrow you'll be killed." So Michal let David down through a window because he couldn't go out the front door because the men were there. And he fled and escaped. Then Michal took an idol and laid it on the bed, covering it with a garment and putting some goat's hair at the head. So she made a little scarecrow or whatever, made a little dummy that she put in the bed to make it look like David was in bed there. I'll go on. When Saul sent the men to capture David, Michal said, "Oh, he's ill. He's sick." So then Saul sent the men back to see David and told them, "Bring him up to me in his bed so that I may kill him. If he's too sick to get out of bed, bring his bed with him." Okay? We got to get rid of him. "I'll kill him if you're too weenie to do this." But when the men entered, there was the idol in the bed, and at the head was some goat's hair. Saul said to Michal, "Why did you deceive me like this and send my enemy away so that he had escaped?" Michal told him, "Oh, he said to me, 'Let me go away. Why should I kill you?'" So Michal tells her dad, "Well, I had to let him go because he threatened to kill me if I didn't." So she saved her own skin there, which is fine because her concern is over David here. So David escaped in the middle of the night. You've got this dummy in the bed kind of thing. Where does David go if he runs away? Where does he go? Does he go back home? Well, if he goes back home to Bethlehem, that's surely where Saul's armies are going to go look for him, and Saul's men will go look for him. So where does he go? Verse 18. When David had fled and made his escape, he went to Samuel. Okay, Samuel's still out there at Ramah. That's where Samuel's hometown was, which isn't too far from Gibeah, just a few miles, and told him all that Saul had done to him. Then he and Samuel went to Naoth and stayed there. Now, Naoth is probably a camp, a little village for the prophets. And so it's there in Ramah. And so it's a little bunch of little homes there is what the picture is there where the prophets live. Well, eventually Saul finds out that David is in Ramah. That's one of two key places he would have gone. And David flees to Samuel, which you would expect. He flees to the man of God here. So Saul... Word came to Saul in verse 19 that David is in Naoth at Ramah, so he sent men to capture him. But when these men saw a group of prophets prophesying with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they also prophesied. So he sent some men after David, and they started acting like prophets too. Obviously, God is protecting David here by putting a spirit on these men. So does Saul recognize that and accept that God's protecting David and give up the hunt? Verse 21. Saul was told about it, and so he sent some more men, and they prophesied too. He then sent men a third time, and they also prophesied. Okay, you get it? Number one, number two, number three, this is all happening. God's protecting this guy, so leave him be. Finally, though, what does Saul do? He left himself for Ramah, and he went to the great cistern at Seku, and he asked, "Word, Samuel and David, over in Naoth at Ramah," they said. So Saul went to Naoth at Ramah, but the Spirit of God came even upon him, and he walked along prophesying until he came to Naoth. He stripped off his robes and also prophesied in Samuel's presence. He lay that way all that day and night. This is why the people say, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" So God not only protected David against Saul's men three times, but he also protected him against Saul. And Saul himself gets involved with prophesying and acting like a prophet here. So, well, Saul's at Naoth in Ramah. Well, David can't stay there, so where does David go? Chapter 20. Then David fled from Naoth at Ramah and went to Jonathan and asked, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he's trying to take my life?" "Never," Jonathan replied. "You are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me, because I'm the heir apparent. I'm the prince that will be king. So he keeps me involved in all of this. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." So where does David go? He goes to his best friend Jonathan, who happens to be the king's son. And Jonathan says, "No, Dad's not trying to kill you." Well, we've just seen that he is. But why does Jonathan think that his dad, Saul, is not trying to kill David? Well, go back to chapter 19, verse 6. We saw this before. Saul listened to Jonathan. This is the last time that we see an interaction with Jonathan and Saul dealing with David. And we see in chapter 19 at the beginning, Saul told Jonathan to kill David as well as his attendants. That's when Jonathan spoke to Saul and defended David, and Saul accepted. And that's where we see in verse 6 that Saul took this oath: "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." So as far as Jonathan is concerned, his dad has said, "No, I'm not going to kill David. I'm fine with David now." In fact, he swore to God. So there's no way that Dad's going to do anything against you, David. Well, why did David think that Jonathan was just ignorant? He didn't realize what Saul's real intent was for killing David. Chapter 20, verse 3. David took an oath and said, "Look, I swear, your father knows very well that I found favor in your eyes." And he said to himself, "Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved. Yet as surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, there's only one step between me and death." Okay? So your dad knows that you like me and you're my friend, and you're going to come to me and tell me if he's trying to kill me, and you're going to try to protect me like he did before. He's not going to let that happen again. He's just not going to let you know that he's trying to kill me. So David devises a test to show Jonathan what his dad's real intent was. We see that in verse 4. Jonathan said to David, "Okay, whatever you want me to do, I'll do for you." So David said, "Look, tomorrow is the new moon festival, and I'm supposed to dine with the king. But let me go and hide in the field until the evening of the day after tomorrow. If your father misses me at all, tell him, 'David earnestly asks my permission to hurry to Bethlehem, his hometown, because an annual sacrifice is being made there for his whole clan.' So if he says, 'Very well,' then your servant is safe. But if he loses his temper, you can be sure that he is determined to harm me." So there's the sign. That's that. Go see how your dad reacts. And if he's upset that I'm gone, then that's your sign that he is trying to kill me. How did David have Jonathan think through his commitment to David here? Verse 8. "As for you," this is David continuing to speak, "as for you, show kindness to your servant, for you've brought him to a covenant with you before the Lord. Remember the covenant we did. Now, if I'm guilty of something deserving death, then you kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father?" "Never," Jonathan said. "If I had the least inkling that my father was determined to harm you, wouldn't I tell you?" David asked, "Well, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" "Come," Jonathan said, "let's go out into the field." So they went out there together. So he reminded Jonathan of the covenant that they had made back in chapter 18 and gave Jonathan an out. Here, if I've done something wrong, kill me. But Jonathan shows his loyalty and shows his love to his friend. Then David says, okay, well, how am I going to know how your dad reacts? So Jonathan has an idea there. And how does Jonathan react? Jonathan said to David, by the Lord, the God of Israel, I surely will sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. Okay, remember that the Hebrew day began at sunset. So this is in the daytime, so tomorrow is tonight. Okay, if that makes sense. What we would call the evening, or tonight, part of today, that was really the next day for the Hebrews. So when we're talking about the full moon meal, okay, the first meal would be tonight, and then the second day would be tomorrow night. And so here he says that, I will surely sound out my father by this time the day after tomorrow. Okay? So, if David misses one meal, that's one thing, but if he misses two of them, that could be another thing. So let's wait till after the two, which there's two meals involved with this new moon festival, and then I'll let you know, or then I'll find out. If he's favorably disposed towards you, will I not send you word and let you know? But if my father is inclined to harm you, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely. Why does he say this stuff? Okay, this doesn't come back to bite him like it did his dad. But it's, you know, again, Jesus said in Matthew 7, don't make oaths. Just let your yes be yes and your no be no. But Jonathan says, may God deal with me ever so severely if I do not let you know and send you away safely. May the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. So you see that Jonathan agreed with and thought it was a good idea that David had, and he said, I will let you know. Okay, by this time, the day after tomorrow. We then see that they affirm their friendship at this point. We saw a covenant before in chapter 18, but now we see a reaffirmation of that. Verse 14, Jonathan says, but show me unfailing kindness like that of the Lord as long as I live, so that I may not be killed. And do not ever cut off your kindness from my family, not even when the Lord has cut off every one of David's enemies from the face of the earth. So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, may the Lord call David's enemies to account. And Jonathan had David reaffirm his oath out of love for him, because he loved him as he loved himself. In verse 23, and Jonathan said, and about the matter you and I discussed, remember, the Lord is witness between you and me forever. So you see that they made and they reconfirmed and reaffirmed oaths to each other using God as the witness. What about the answer to David's question earlier? How will David find out how Saul responds? Backing up to verse 18. Jonathan said to David, tomorrow's a new moon festival. You'll be missed because your seat will be empty. The day after tomorrow, toward evening, go to the place where you hid when this trouble began, and wait by the stone Ezel. I will shoot three arrows to the side of it, as though I were shooting at a target. Then I'll send a boy and say, go, find the arrows. If I say to him, look, the arrows are on this side of you, bring them here, well then come, because as surely as the Lord lives, you are safe. There is no danger. But if I say to the boy, look, the arrows are beyond you, then you must go, because the Lord has sent you away. So that's the sign. That's the sign that would tell David whether or not Saul is trying to kill him. Jonathan couldn't just go to David. Okay, it would be too risky. Saul's men could follow him and know where David is. So he gives him this sign. So what happens? What happens the first night of the festival? In other words, what happens that evening? Verse 24. So David hid in the field, and when the new moon festival came, the king sat down to eat. He sat in his customary place by the wall opposite Jonathan, and Abner sat next to Saul, but David's place was empty. Saul said nothing that day, for he thought, something must have happened to David to make him ceremonially unclean. Surely he is unclean. There was a question, and he missed David, but didn't think a lot of it. He thought, well, maybe he's just unclean. What about the second night? But the next day, the second day of the month, David's place was empty again. Then Saul said to his son Jonathan, why hasn't the son of Jesse come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Jonathan answered, "Well, David earnestly asked me for permission to go to Bethlehem. He said, 'Let me go because our family is observing a sacrifice in the town, and my brother has ordered me to be there. If I found favor in your eyes, let me get away to see my brothers.' That's why he hasn't come to the king's table." Saul missed him, and he had noticed that he was gone the first night. So he asked where David was, and Jonathan gave this answer that he had planned. How did Saul respond? This is the moment of truth, verse 30. Saul's anger flared up at Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman, don't I know that you sided with the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother who bore you?" So how does he react? Not very well. He gets mad at Jonathan for siding with David. Now this phrase here, "you son of a perverse and rebellious woman," he's really not talking about Jonathan's mom, and Jonathan's mom being not a good woman. He's talking more about Jonathan. This is an idiom that we've got a phrase like that. We abbreviate it SOB. Same sort of connotation there. Denigration of David. He's cursing cursing Jonathan here. He's upset with Jonathan. He's upset that Jonathan sided with David, but he also feels that Jonathan is stupid here because he should be opposed to David just like Saul is. Why is that? Verse 31. "As long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Now, send him and bring him to me, for he must die." In other words, he is the threat to your throne, Jonathan. You are the next in line for the throne, and as long as he's still around, that threat exists. We need to get rid of him to protect your throne, to protect you and your future. Was Jonathan concerned with protecting the throne? If we turn ahead to chapter 23, we see results of this. This is Jonathan and David again later. "While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. 'Don't be afraid,' he said. 'My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this.' So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord again. Then Jonathan went home, and David remained at Horesh." So you see, Jonathan realized and recognized early on that God had blessed David, that God had plans for David, that the kingship, even though Jonathan might be next in line to be king due to birth, he was not next in line according to God's choice. That went to David. But his friendship with David, he didn't feel threatened by it at all. He didn't feel that was his rightful position. The rightful position was up to God. So you see Jonathan's faithfulness through all of this. We've seen the whole time that Jonathan was a faithful man after God's heart, just like his friend David was, unlike his father Saul. Okay, Jonathan had the faithfulness that his father Saul was called to have. And Jonathan didn't question God's choice of David. He felt protected by it, in fact. He said, "You'll be the king, David, and I'll be second to you." And that doesn't bother Jonathan. Saul wants to kill David. How serious is Saul's intent to kill David here? Verse 32. "Why should he die? What has he done?" Jonathan asked his father. But Saul hurled his spear at him to kill him. Then Jonathan knew that his father intended to kill David. He wanted David. He was so upset with David that he even threw a spear at Jonathan and tried to kill his own son for siding with David. You see a real screwed up man here in Saul, don't you? How does Jonathan react once he realizes that his father really wants to kill David? Verse 34. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger. And you can imagine there's probably words there that he said. He was very upset. On that second day of the month, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In the morning then, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. Okay? So he was upset. Jonathan was upset by the realization that his dad really wanted to kill David. He didn't eat. He left in the morning. He waited till the morning because that was the next day was going to be the time when he would give the sign to David. He then got up in the morning and went out. He took a boy with him. Did he give David the secret sign as he promised? Verse 35. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, "Run and find the arrows that I shoot." And as the boy ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out, "Isn't the arrow beyond you?" And he shouted, "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing of all this. Only Jonathan and David knew what was going on. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the boy and said, "Go, carry him back to the town." So you see that he did, he provided the sign to David just as he promised he would. Okay? And but you see he adds a few more words that are meaningful to David and Jonathan. "Hurry, go quickly, don't stop." So it's very clear to David, yes, Jonathan has realized that his dad wants to kill me. What's interesting, though, is he gave this sign, and the sign was there so that Jonathan wouldn't make physical connection with David, come into physical presence, because that was risky, because people would find out where David was, and that was risky for David. But Jonathan couldn't just let this go. So we see that they do come out. He sends the boy home with the weapons, and then verse 41, after the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone and bowed down before Jonathan three times with his face to the ground. Then they kissed each other and wept together, but David wept the most. Okay, so David was very upset. Jonathan was very upset. They cried together because they were going to have to part ways. And it was sad for David to see that his good friend realized that his dad was so screwed up. What were their last words before David left? Verse 42. Jonathan said to David, "Go in peace, for we've sworn friendship with each other in the name of God, saying, 'The Lord is witness between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever.'" And then David left and Jonathan went back to town. So you see, every time you turn around, you've got this friendship being recommitted here. So there's, we see the friendship of David and Jonathan. And we'll pick up from there with the story next week. But how did it turn out? Did Jonathan end up serving under David as he said? In other words, he said, we saw earlier that Jonathan said that you'll be king and I'll be second in command. Did that end up happening? If you look at the very last verse of 1 Samuel, well, the very last chapter, chapter 31, we see that the Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. However, the Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Saul, which you see in the next verses, as well as his sons Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. The intent was there. Jonathan recognized his position, but Jonathan never got to rule with David. He was killed in battle here, the same time that Saul was killed. How did David respond to this loss? Well, that's what you see in that chapter, 2 Samuel chapter 1, that next chapter. Just a few key verses. This man comes in from the Israelite camp from the battle and comes to David in Ziklag. And what happened, David asked? "Tell me." He said, "The men fled from the battle. Many of them fell and died. And Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." Now, this guy who brings this message is thinking, I've got good news for him, because he can now be king. Saul is dead. Then the next one to claim the throne, Jonathan, is dead. So he thinks this is going to be good news for David. Is it good news for David? Verse 11. "Then David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them." Tearing your clothes. Clothes were very expensive. People didn't have a bunch of sets of clothes. You know, you take a look. We've got machines to do all this weaving of our fabric. They didn't have that. It was all done by hand. So people had one, two, maybe three sets of clothes. Most people had one or two sets of clothes. So tearing your clothes is not something that you'd ever want to have happen. So when someone tore their clothes, it was a sign of extreme grief. "So David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and they wept and they fasted until evening for Saul and for his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." So you see that David was very upset about this, very upset about the loss of his friend's life, Jonathan. Verse 17, we see that David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan. And you've got this song that he made. In fact, it says that he ordered in verse 18 that the men of Judah be taught this lament, so that everyone would know this song. And the memory of Saul and Jonathan would remain. In verse 26, he also says in there, I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. He felt this strong friendship with Jonathan, and he grieved very deeply for Jonathan, mourning the loss of Jonathan and Saul. So, there we have the end of the story of loving friendship between David and Jonathan, the son of Saul. Is that the end? Remember, the covenants that Jonathan and David had promised to each other were covenants that would endure forever. Okay? My generations to your generations, my descendants and your descendants. Did it continue beyond Jonathan's death? 2 Samuel chapter 9, we see a story, and we'll just get a few verses there. David asked, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul to whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Okay, so you see he's concerned about that. Verse 3, Ziba answered the king, well, there's still a son of Jonathan. He's crippled in both feet. So there, Jonathan does have a son. Verse 6, when Mephibosheth, that's the name of this son, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay him honor. David said, Mephibosheth, your servant, he replied. Don't be afraid, David said. I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belongs to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table. So you see that David shows kindness, shows his love for Jonathan in taking care of Jonathan's son. Jonathan's son who could not take care of himself and depended then on David for survival. And he provided for him. So what a great friendship. Great examples of friendship for us as we are called to befriend others. Now, if we're to follow this example as friends, how often should we love? What times in a friendship is love really called for? Well, we see an example of David and Jonathan. We see that in Proverbs 17, verse 17. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. So a friend, the love that a friend has for a friend is always there. Good times and bad. A friend loves at all times. How much? How much as a friend can you love your friend? Well, we see that back in 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1. It says, after David finished talking with Saul, this is from the very beginning, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. Love for a friend can be the same level of love that you have for yourself. How close can you get as a friend? Proverbs 18, verse 24 says that there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. You've heard about blood runs thick and love in families is thick. Well, here we have a friend who can be closer than a brother. What is the greatest way that a friend can show his love? Well, Jesus talked about that because Jesus gave us a great example of the love that a friend can have for a friend and the love that he had for us. Verse 13 of John chapter 15 says, greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. The greatest love you can have for someone, friend or otherwise, is to give yourself up for them. So how do we show that we're Jesus' friends? Jesus says, you are my friends if you do what I command. So what is it that he commands? If you zoom down to verse 17, this is my command, love each other. So as we love one another, we fulfill the commands of Christ, and we show that we are his friend. How does Jesus show us that he's called us his friends? Verse 15, Jesus says, I no longer call you servants because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends. For everything that I learned from my Father, I've made known to you. So he reveals everything that God's revealed to him. Why did he choose us as his friends? Verse 16. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last. Then the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. So we are friends. We are friends. We're called to be friends with each other as we love one another as Christ first loved us. And in doing so, Christ calls us his friends. He reveals himself to us. He reveals God's will to us, God's spirit to us, God's plan for our lives, our plan, his plan for us to go and bear fruit among our friends and to bring others into the eternal life and salvation that he's given us. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank and praise you for the love that you've poured out on us, the great way that you befriended us through your Son, Jesus Christ, that you showed us the love that is the greatest love a friend can have for another, and that is he laid down his life for us so that we could then come to you and be with you and be with him forever. Thank you for the story of David and Jonathan and the love that was shared between the two. Forgive us when we do not have the kind of relationships and let our egos and sinful personal desires get in the way of showing the love that you've called us to share with one another. Send your spirit among us so that we may do your work and bear your fruit and be friends to those that you place in our lives. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.